Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I'm here with my dear friend and colleague, Lindsay Paris Lopez. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, Adam. Hi, everyone.
I'm excited to continue our series on Tony Bartlett's book, Seven Stories, How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible. And this is our fourth week, which means we're on our fourth chapter of the book, and the chapter is titled Wrath to Compassion.
Yes. So this is the fourth of seven, which means it is right in the middle, right at the heart of the matter.
This is the heart of the book, from wrath to compassion. I like that.
It is. It is the heart of the book. You know, when I did my interview with Tony Bartlett at the very beginning, which provides an overview of the whole book, I knew I wouldn't be able to read the whole thing before I interviewed him. So I read the methodology, and he told me, if you read one chapter, read this one. Oh, so this is the most important. I mean, reading it from the beginning definitely helps. Don't get me wrong. We are taking a journey from a wrathful understanding of God to a compassionate understanding of God. And it's a long journey, and every single chapter helps and takes us a step further on that journey. But this is really the heart of the matter, the shift in human perception of God from wrath to compassion, and what that does for us, what that does for the way we relate to each other.
What does it do for us, do you think? Like, this is the practical theological question in our understanding of God, what it does to us. What do you think that is?
I mean, I really think that understanding that God is love and understanding what that means and knowing that it means forgiveness, it means mercy, it should serve to make us more merciful. It should serve to make us more compassionate. It should make us more understanding. And that doesn't mean that we will just be complacent with evil or sin, which we understand to be poor ways of relating to each other, you know, mean, non-compassionate, malicious ways of relating to each other, or apathetic ways of relating to each other. We don't just let those slide, but we come from a place of mercy and compassion ourselves. And we remember that everyone else is made in the image of mercy and compassion. It helps me to approach people with just remembering that they are made in the image of love too. So when I want to be angry at them, I try to approach from, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt, give them, try to understand where they are coming from, you know, things like that. It makes a world of difference. I think that if we understand God as a God of love, we will stop things like capital punishment. We'll make our prisons restorative rather than retributive. We will change the culture of law enforcement to de-escalate crimes rather than punish them and treat everyone with respect instead of enmity. I think it has enormous impact all over the world, and from the very personal to the international.
Yeah, Tony talks about these semiotic shifts, these radical shifts in our understanding of God. And it's a shift that Tony says that you see happening throughout the Hebrew scriptures, but especially in 2 Isaiah, where you really start to see this shift happening, and Jesus takes up this second Isaiah mantle. And the early Christians believe this too. So we've been trying this semiotic shift for 2,500 years, whenever second Isaiah was finally written down and edited. But we're still struggling with it. And one of the pop culture things that you wrote about recently was noticing this in the recent NBC program, Jesus Christ Superstar. And you wrote an article about that. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found in that play?
Right. Well, I kind of seized my opportunity to write a little bit about Jesus Christ Superstar, because the last section of chapter 4 is about the cup of wrath that Jesus drinks, which of course is what the song Gethsemane in Jesus Christ Superstar is all about. Jesus calls it a cup of poison. And at first he's praying, take this cup away from me, for I don't want to taste its poison. And you don't get the sense that God poured this cup. You don't get the sense that Jesus believes God is doing this evil to him. You know that he's being chased by, I mean, you've seen the priests who want to kill him. So you don't attribute their desire to kill him with God. But by the end of the song, Jesus is raging at God and saying, "This, I will drink your cup of poison," and saying, "Nail me to your cross." That's in both versions, but the NBC version took it a bit further and changed the original lyrics, "God, thy will is hard, but you hold every card," to "God, thy will be done, destroy your only son." Now, Jesus knows he's about to die, and he's terrified, and he's probably uncertain of what the future will be. I mean, he's already talked about his resurrection, but he could be doubtful in the last hour. I would not say that he couldn't be. I mean, it's always a question how much Jesus knows, how much Jesus doesn't know, and how much his mortal humanity might take a toll on his mission. That's always a question. So I don't want to say I know the answer. But I'd like to think that he received more comfort in the garden, that he left the garden, maybe not knowing what was going to happen, but knowing that God would still be with him, still feeling a connection to God rather than a separation. And for a lot of Christians, I think, for a lot of people see the cross as Jesus' ultimate separation from God, but it need not be. In fact, Jesus says, "I only do what I see the Father doing." So in a mysterious way, he sees the Father drinking the cup. He sees the Father on the cross. He sees the Father tortured. And he experiences that torture in all of the broken relationships of humanity and all the pain that we cause each other. I think Jesus is intimately connected to God throughout all of it, from the garden through his last breath and onward. And I love this movie. I wanted to give this show the benefit of the doubt for the longest time, but I couldn't ignore that change. I couldn't ignore "destroy your only son" and having Jesus being almost against God, having Jesus seeing God as his destroyer, as his murderer. I couldn't just let that go. I'll agree that he's angry. I'll agree that he's frustrated and confused. But I'd like to think that he feels comfort from God and not this cold distance that the show gives us. So I could talk forever about this.
What is the cup? Tony talks about the cup throughout this chapter. And it's important to understand what the cup symbolizes and the shift that it takes with Jesus and with Isaiah, right? So the cup is often seen in Hebrew scriptures as the cup of wrath that one nation brings to another nation in the constant conquest that was happening in the ancient world. So what is the cup of wrath? It's the cup that the Assyrians are going to bring against us. It's the cup that the Babylonians are going to bring against us. It's all of these nations that are bringing the cup of wrath. And there are times in the Hebrew scriptures where it appears that God is behind that cup. That God is bringing forth the Assyrians as a punishment to Israel for what they've done. But there are also times when you see this separation, this idea that it's not God that's behind this, but that it is just the human cup of wrath. So you get this teasing out that's happening, especially in Isaiah and ultimately in Jesus, of this idea of this kind of confusion of whose cup of wrath is this?
Yeah, I think this is a place where seeing the rest of the interpretation of scripture that Tony takes us through helps us to have a better understanding of where we are at this point. We began with the idea that God is a God of justice and that God is not on the side of the mighty Egyptian conquerors, but on the side of the enslaved and oppressed. And that the Hebrew people are not just an ethnicity, but a group of people brought together by their own struggle with oppression and injustice and marginalization. So we see from the beginning that God is a God of the vulnerable. And so we begin with that understanding. And then last week we talked about the land and what the people felt when they were given the land, of what it means to receive land as people who didn't have a land or belonging or stability before, and what it means to lose that land again and to be conquered and have it taken away. And the idea was that God wasn't necessarily with the mighty. God wasn't necessarily on the side of the mighty, but if you disobey God's will, if you do not follow God's laws, then the punishment of God is on you. And so that's the Deuteronomic viewpoint, that God's punishment is on those who do not obey. And that kind of works hand in hand with the idea that God is on the side of might, or it gives another spin to that, because people are coming in and conquering the Hebrew people, and there is destruction and there is re-enslavement, new captivities, and just all kinds of devastation, you know. And this is saying, instead of God being on the side of the strong, God is angry with you because you disobeyed and therefore this is your punishment. So that connects the idea of punishment and wrath with being conquered without necessarily saying God is on the side of the conquerors. But I think human minds get it mixed up and bring those together. So there's on the one hand the idea that God could be with the powerful, because we still see God in power and wrath. And then there's on the other hand, there's this idea now that this is still our God. He's just very, very mad at us. And I don't usually say he for God, but I think this is very angry masculine imagery, which is not to say that all masculine imagery is angry, but this is angry masculine imagery. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Tony brings up Isaiah 49 verses 14 through 16, which says, But Israel said to me, the Lord has forsaken me. My Lord has forgotten me. Can a woman forget her nursing child or show no compassion for the child of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you. So one of the things that Isaiah, second Isaiah, is doing is moving from this view of this wrathful, angry God that may look more masculine to a more feminine imagery of God, this God who has compassion for the child that's in her womb. I mean, this is like really intimate, compassionate love that just like when a baby is in a womb, the mother can't think, oh, I'm going to love or not love this child. It's just automatically I'm like the womb supports the child. Like, so God's love for us is automatic.
Right. There is a shift to more feminine imagery and a shift to a more compassionate understanding of God. And that shift is going on throughout all of Scripture. But we get a very clear sense of it in 2 Isaiah and the Song of the Suffering Servant, which the whole passion of Jesus fulfills in a way and, you know, refers back to over and over. So we have the connection from Jesus on the cross to the suffering servant that we learn about. And the whole, the suffering servant is the first lesson of this chapter in From Wrath to Compassion.
Yeah, and it's really important to understand the suffering servant because it often has gotten twisted in order to support a penal and substitutionary understanding of what Jesus is doing on the cross. Mm-hmm. So Tony does this really excellent job of bringing us through understanding what the text is actually saying, right, which is always important. But one of the things that's really crucial in this, and I've heard Jews talk about their understanding of the suffering servant as well, which is not the penal substitutionary understanding of atonement. So what it is, you know, is this human understanding in the text of we considered him stricken by God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the human understanding that we thought that he was stricken by God, but he wasn't stricken by God. He was stricken by our own violent tendencies. This is the shift that Tony brings out that's happening in the text, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Actually, I mean, there are actually four psalms of the suffering servant, but we'll look mostly at the fourth song of the suffering servant, which is from Isaiah 52:13 to 53:12. And starting with 53 verse 4, Tony has reinterpreted the song of the suffering servant in order to help us understand it from the perspective not of penal substitutionary atonement, but of the Girardian understanding of scapegoating violence and the way out of that through recognizing our violence and being forgiven for it. Chapter 53, verse 4 says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our diseases, yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God, and afflicted." And that's the idea that when we have a scapegoat, we think we are so righteous. We just believe so much in our own rightness that we think that God is cursing the same person that we are. It always works out that way. We think that we're right and that God hates the same people that we hate.
One of the keys for this Isaiah text is not just that we considered him stricken by God, but it's also Isaiah's response to this scapegoating, right? Because mm-hmm. what we typically do is when some people scapegoat us, we attempt to scapegoat them back. We mimic the scapegoating, right? Mm-hmm. But this is where we see that God's will is not to scapegoat back. It's not to scapegoat the scapegoaters. It's to work for justice, yes, but do so non-violently. So this is, Tony says, Isaiah, this is the Isaiah text that approves of a non-violent figure before Jesus comes on the scene.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why Jesus didn't, or why the suffering servant doesn't open his mouth. Mm-hmm. You know, we're spewing all this hatred and anger. And I want to be careful here to reiterate that throughout Jesus's lifetime, Jesus hardly said nothing. You know, he did speak up for justice over and over and over. But when he's on trial and the whole world is against him, he doesn't speak against his accusations. And maybe, I don't know, but maybe it's because he's so angry that he can't speak back without mirroring the accusation, so he chooses not to speak at all. I mean, maybe it's an act of restraint because at that point, communication would be futile, because at that point, anger would take over, because that's what it does to our human brains.
Right. So. And your point about justice is well taken. Mm-hmm. Tony points out that in the first suffering servant song, that justice is what the Isaiah figure is moving towards, but it's a justice not through the sword, but through teachings.
Right. Yes.
So it's not, it's, this is again, a resisting of an impulse towards violence or a move towards violence, and one towards teachings. Like the sword that comes forth from Isaiah is the teaching. It comes from the mouth. The word is like a double-edged sword. And this is also, we see this in Revelation, that crazy text, the Revelation, where the sword, when Jesus comes back, the sword comes from his mouth. This is classic imagery of, not of a literal sword, but a metaphorical sword of teachings. This is a nonviolent teachings that's rooted way back in Isaiah. So,
and to call the sword, to call it a sword, that emphasizes the fact that when we call out, injustice, when we call out our own participation in injustice, and we call out the participation of our loved ones in injustice, when we call out not just the people that we always speak against because we don't like what they're doing. And I have plenty of people like that in politics and in life that I can say they are definitely wrong, you know. But when we call out injustice among our friends, among our family, among our own selves, when we do that, that is divisive rather than uniting. That is a sword that cuts because, you know, we don't want to look at our own, we don't want to look at the log in our own eyes, and we really want to know who we are over and against others. And it can mess with our sense of identity. It really messes with our sense of identity when we learn we were very wrong about something.
Right.
And especially when we try to live our lives helping people to realize that we might have done something that's hurt people, that can be devastating. So it is a sword. It is something that cuts, but it is not a sword of violence. It's a sword of truth that in the end will bring us back together, but it's going to take some, it's going to take some education and some humbling. I really like the whole of Tony's interpretation of the suffering servant. I think we should just read through that, because some of the pushback I got from my article was, how can you interpret this nonviolently? How can you not see penal substitutionary atonement in this? So I think it's important to go through and see how this, it sounds like penal substitutionary atonement because it uses a lot of it, because we draw on that theory from this language. But what this language is doing is subverting the idea of God needing blood and sacrifice to pay for our sins. It's subverting the idea that God would want any kind of violence to atone for violence and sin in the first place. So while we read through Tony's interpretation, it's on page 126. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our diseases, yet we accounted him struck down by God and afflicted. But, in other words, he was wounded by reason of our ill deeds and broken by reason of our wrong ways. So, his suffering is not because of God's punishment, but because of the human system of violence that he is revealing in his own suffering. Upon him was the instruction that was for our wholeness, and by his bruises we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, all have turned to our own way, and the Lord brought it about that the wrong ways of us all fell on him. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Who of his generation shall reflect that by a perversion of justice he was taken away? He was cut off from the land of the living through my people's offense, to whom the stroke was due. They made his grave with the wicked and his tomb with the rich, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord that he be brought down by grief. As you make his life an event that takes away sins, thus he shall see his offspring and shall prolong his days. Through him the will of the Lord shall prosper. Out of his anguish he shall see, he shall find satisfaction. Through his knowledge the righteous one, my servant, shall make many righteous, and he shall bear their wrong ways.
Now, when people hear this, many are going to say, see, there it is in verse 10. Yet it was the will of the Lord that he be brought down by grief.
Right.
So what is the will of the Lord? That's the big question.
It is the will of the Lord that we see what our violence does. It is the will of the Lord that we look upon what our violence does to destroy people. It's the will of the Lord that we see the innocence of our victims. And no matter what, we're all human. And I mean, the big idea is that Jesus didn't sin, and that's why he can bear this punishment. But for anyone else, we have sinned, and therefore we all deserve this, but only Jesus takes it on who doesn't deserve it. The fact is, when we kill, when we hurt, when we insult, the person we are killing and hurting and insulting may not be perfect, but that doesn't mean that they deserve what we give them. No one deserves the brutality that Jesus displays on the cross. No one deserves this kind of violence. And we are not in a position to deal it out because we are the ones who are violent too. If we can do this to another person, then we are violent.
I think that's the key to understanding this verse. Yet it was the will of the Lord that he be brought down by grief. It's interesting because it's passive. Like, what is the will of the Lord that he be brought down by grief? But who is the one who's bringing him down?
Right.
The will of the Lord is the will of the Lord in Isaiah and in Jesus is for them to stay nonviolent. And so who is the one who is bringing him down by grief?
Well, this is Tony's translation, though. And other translations would say it was the will of the Lord to crush him and use that active verb. So if we see God behind the violence of humanity, if we see violence as the ultimate power that humans wield by the will of God, then we might make an active translation of this. If we see God's power as wholly other than our violence, then we might make the translation, it was the will of God for him to experience our violence in order to show us what it does. We could, you know, if we interpret God as violent, we will probably translate this actively. So this whole story is teaching us to, you know, all of the seven stories, the whole Bible, and this interpretation of it is teaching us to disassociate our idea that violence is from God, so that we will translate it in a passive way, so that we will understand that it's not God's will to actively crush him, but it is God's will that we understand our own violence, and this is the way God shows it to us.
Yeah, Jesus and the cross, one of the things that people often say is that Jesus drank the cup of God's wrath once and for all. But Tony brings up this point from Mark chapter 10 that Jesus says that he's going to drink the cup, and he asks his disciples, are you able to drink the cup that I drink? And then Jesus says, the cup that I drink, you will drink too. So this isn't, according to Jesus, a cup that he will only drink once in his life, but it's a cup that from God, the cup of wrath that he will drink from God's cup of wrath. But it's a cup that all of the disciples will drink. This is why do they drink it? Not because it's God's wrath, but because it's the human cup that they will end up drinking. And they were all 10 of the 11 of them that stayed with him. They were all killed by the empire, and John of Patmos didn't fare out much better. He was exiled to Patmos. So this is like, as this is happening. So that's one of the things that he brings up. The other one is people will often say Jesus goes to the cross so that we can be forgiven for our sins. But Jesus goes throughout his ministry forgiving people before he goes to the cross.
Mm-hmm.
So forgiveness is freely given before he even goes to the cross. So it's not about us being forgiven, because he forgives previously to that. So what is the cross about?
Right. I mean, this does not stop human violence for all time. I mean, there was never a more obvious sentence spoken by anyone than the one I just said. So what does it do? This, I think, is where mimetic theory is so important, because we learn by models. We are not instinctive creatures that just go after what we need to survive based on an innate instinct. We have desires based on what we see other people desiring, and we form our ideas and identities through what we see of others. And we all have unique combinations of what we see and what we process, so we're all different, and yet we're intimately connected with everyone. What that means is that we need a model to show us how to respond to violence. And the idea that Jesus is a perfect model who shows us the way seems rather disconnected to some people. It seems like, well, we see Jesus and we copy him, and that's the power of Jesus. It doesn't seem like enough. But what mimetic theory teaches us is that it's not just that we see and copy, it's we see and our brains are changed in the seeing. That our brains are designed so that they are altered by the models that we choose. And I mean, it's really affecting us at a cellular level. It's not just something passive, or it's not just a, I think we've got to understand that the idea of Jesus as a model goes much deeper than the words might sound. And I also think that there is something more than that on the cross. It might be harder for me to explain, but I think that the model that Jesus gives us to show us how to respond to violence in a nonviolent way, not just in his death, but in the way he speaks truth to power, in the way he embraces the outcasts, all of it, and ultimately being willing to die rather than to kill, being willing to die in the place of others. I think it's more than just a model, but I don't think we should say it's just a model, like be dismissive of the modeling aspect of it. I mean, I want to say also that if it's just a legal transaction, that God requires this blood for your life, if it's just that, I mean, people say that being a model isn't enough, but if it's payment to the wrath of God, I think that that lessens it. I think that that cheapens it. I mean, because what I'm talking about, what Tony's talking about, is a change in what it means to be human. By having this model of nonviolence, it changes us at a structural, basic level. And that change is not, it's not immediate, it's a whole evolution. And that's why there's still violence in the world. We are still undergoing that change. But it's not just a transaction that is required for, you know, as payment for our lives. You know, I mean, if that's the way that people interpret the cross, I don't want to belittle the people who interpret it that way. But I do want to open up the idea that there's so much more going on in Jesus, that Jesus is completing our humanity, that humanity, to be human and to be made in the image of God, means to be made in relationship, to be made for relationship. And it changes our relationship with each other from violence and I am me because I am, you know, I am me because I am better than my enemies and I'm not them. It changes our whole way of being human to a deeper connection with God and with everybody, with all of creation. So, yeah,
that's beautiful. For me, the cross is, on a very personal level, it is that old hymn, "Were you there when they crucified my Lord?" And for me, the answer has always been, yes, I was there. I was there shouting, "Crucify him." I get caught up in these scapegoating mechanisms all the time. And, you know, I wish that I didn't. But there's all of these little traps that get stuck in my mind where I am constantly comparing myself over and against others. And the cross says to me, "Adam, you are forgiven. Let's try a new way. Let's try something different." And, you know, just like the disciples got caught up in it, and I assume they got caught up in it afterwards, they were constantly met by the resurrected Jesus, who says, "Peace be with you. Let's try again. Let's try a new way." And I think that's might be where Tony is going in the fifth chapter, from victim to vindication. Vindication is the resurrection, and Jesus, the way of Jesus, is vindicated in the resurrection. Not a vindication over and against his enemies again, but a vindication of the ways of nonviolence and peace. Jesus was resurrected, and that resurrection says, "Yes, this is ultimate. This is the way of God." The way of nonviolence, the way of peace. And that's what God invites us to live into, despite the fact that I constantly go in the other direction. The resurrected Jesus constantly meets me and says, "Adam, let's try again."
Yes.
That's the cross and the resurrection for me.
Yeah.
And I get into trouble. I get into trouble when I used to say, "Yeah, this is it. And you need to live this way." And I have a hard enough time living this way. So I've stopped like saying, "You," shaking my finger, "you need to do this and this and this and this and this." I have a hard enough time making sure that I do it. So that's the other part that you're talking about in modeling, why it's so important to model this is even like the teaching of it can be shaking your finger at people. But I think just living it out, this like forgiveness that I need, not so much that like you need or someone else needs, but that I need, is a good way. And accepting that for myself and trying to live out of it is a good way of modeling it for the world.
Absolutely. And I mean, I see that model in my Christian friends and my non-Christian friends. I mean, there was a point at which I felt the need to get everyone to believe as I did. And I don't necessarily believe the way that I did then anymore anyway. But yeah, coming to the realization that it's not about making anyone else believe. It's about striving to follow this model as best you can. Once you have chosen to take this model for your own. And there are plenty of people who don't actively choose this model, and yet Jesus's love has been diffused through the whole world in such a way that people might not even think of Jesus and yet live like Jesus. And people can find Jesus's model in people of all kinds of religions. In fact, when we were talking about the sword of truth earlier, and how hard it is to speak justice against, or not against, but to speak up and speak for justice to your own family, your own friends, even your own self. I thought there's a verse in the Quran that says exactly that. And you can find this model of living towards the full and complete humanity of nonviolent love and non-rivalrous relationship. You can find it everywhere throughout the world.
Amen. Jesus says, I have sheep that are not of this fold. It's so expansive and beautiful. And I think that's a great way to end it. So thank you, Lindsay, for discussing wrath to compassion. We would love it if you who are listening to this or watching this have any comments. We'd love to read them. So thank you for watching or listening. We invite you to join us next week as we talk about chapter 5, from victim to vindication. So you can stay up to date on all things Ravencast by liking the Raven Foundation Facebook page and by heading over to the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org. Until then, grace and peace be with you.